I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Brownie Wise was a pioneering businesswoman who headed up the sales division of the Orlando-based Tupperware Company. Local news reporter and author Bob Keeling chronicled her life in the company and Central Florida in his 2008 book, Tupperware Unsealed.
She shattered the glass ceiling when it came to Tupperware. She was the head of the sales division, there's no doubt about it.
That book's now set to be made into a movie starring Sandra Bullock and directed by Tate Taylor. I spoke to Keeling about the life of Brownie Wise in Central Florida, as well as his work in the Jack Kerouac Writer-in-Residence program. A conversation with Bob Keeling on Brownie Wise and her legacy at Tupperware, that's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Bob Keeling. Bob is a reporter at Wesh TV. He's the co-founder of the Jack Kerouac Writer-in-Residence Project of Orlando. His book, Tupperware Unsealed, Brownie Wise, Earl Tupper and the Home Party Pioneers, is set to be adopted into a movie by Sony Pictures. Bob, thanks for coming in and welcome back to Intersection.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the Tupperware Company. This is an interesting company. It's still going pretty strong, I understand. It was founded here in Orlando in 1948. How did it get started?
Well, Earl Tupper founded the company up in Massachusetts, and he was a brilliant inventor, no doubt about it. But the issue that he had was that he just could not find a way to sell the product. Then finally, along comes this shining star from what used to be Stanley Home Products out in suburban Detroit, Brownie Wise. But she had gone to the management folks and told them of her aspirations, and they basically patted her on the head and said, honey, management is no place for a woman. So she switched over to selling Tupperware. At about the same time, her teenaged protege from Stanley Home Products, a guy named Gary McDonald, had seen Tupperware in a department store in Detroit and thought it would be a great demonstration product. And sure enough, they started selling it by the boatload through the Home Party plan to be able to demonstrate the burp, demonstrate the product. That's how things got rolling. That's how Tupper took notice of her, because she was selling so much out there in Detroit. And finally, she and a handful of other very accomplished and successful distributors convinced Tupper, let's take it off the store shelves and let's sell it only through the party plan. And he made Brownie Wise his general manager of Tupperware Home Parties in 51. And that's where the product really took off.
Mm-hmm. So where's the Orlando connection? When did that start?
Well, Brownie was very interested in having her life and her career down here in Florida. And so she had been assigned to come down here and be a distributor for Tupperware. Basically, she had most of the state and was just doing a bang-up job. And then Tupper discovered her and put her in management. And she said, yeah, I would be willing to do that, but I'd like to do it in Florida. So they went back and forth. She actually wanted to do Tupperware Home Parties in this nice stretch of sort of beachfront property in Jupiter. Tupper was looking at some land in Stark, the home of the state prison, and yeah, Old Sparky. Kind of shows the difference in their personalities right there. But he became aware that Earl O'Bronson was selling land cheap here in Central Florida, and that got on his radar. So he bought 1,000 acres of swampland down along 441 and eventually turned that into their world headquarters. But in the meantime, while that was going on, Tupperware Home Parties actually spent what I call their freshman year here in Orlando. Mm-hmm. And they started with just a handful of people in an old World War II hangar at Orlando Executive Airport. Brownie herself actually lived in this beautiful Art Deco house on Dubs Dread Golf Course. And that's really how it all got started right here in Central Florida.
Is that house still there?
It is still there. And actually, I'm glad you asked about that, because I would like to see some sort of historic preservation conversation started about that particular house on Dubs Dread Circle, because it is right on the golf course. There have been a number of large sort of what I call McMansions built, mm-hmm, and I would like to see that home perhaps given historic recognition, because it's beautiful and it looks exactly the way it did when there's a picture on the back of my book where here's Tupper handing Brownie the keys to a new Cadillac in the front yard of that very house which still looks much the same today.
Mm, they don't make cars like that anymore.
No, they don't.
It's interesting. I mean, obviously, you're very involved with the Jack Kerouac project. The house he lived in, he spent time here in Florida. It's not that assuming looking. It's not. You wouldn't say that's a great example of architecture. So a little bit of a difference there, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. But in another sense, you know, they're only a couple of miles apart there in College Park. And really, both of these iconic American figures, one in literature, one in business, started the same way. I mean, their paths were sort of parallel. They started, you know, there's Kerouac living in this crummy back porch apartment, living hand to mouth, practically broke. Well, Brownie comes in 51 and 52, and she's, you know, not a big, huge success, and Tupperware is certainly not a household name. But by the time she moves away at the end of 52, and at the time Kerouac moves away from that little shotgun shack there not far away, both had become, you know, they were well on their way to being iconic American figures.
Mm-hmm. And the whole fact that, you know, this is a center where, I mean, I guess it still is, land is very important here in Central Florida. A lot of the, you know, what brings businesses here is kind of due to the cheap abundance of land. That's, of course, how Disney got started here, and Tupperware the same way.
And another big part of that was Florida is a non-union state, and Earl Tupper hated unions, and that was a big part of the appeal. And Brownie thought, you know, if we had this appeal of the sunshine, we'd be able to attract our dealers to come down on their own dime, by the way, and be trained for us and, you know, learn the newest selling programs and incentives. And that's indeed what happened with the Tupperware Jubilee that happened every year.
How far up the chain of command did Brownie move? You know, you talk about the fact that she was told early on, management is no place for a woman. She turned around and proved people wrong. But was there still a glass ceiling that she wasn't able to kind of get through?
Well, that's an interesting question, because she shattered the glass ceiling when it came to Tupperware. She was the head of the sales division. There's no doubt about it. But one of the interesting things about her is, while she absolutely adored her dealers and her distributors and wanted to help people help themselves, when it came to management, while she broke the glass ceiling, she didn't bring any other women along with her. And it was basically, one time she was stated as saying, look, if there's going to be a diva around here, it's going to be me. So she did pave a way for women, but not necessarily the ones closest to her.
Mm-hmm. What got you interested in the story?
I watched a PBS documentary on Tupperware about 10 years ago. And I call myself like a five-alarm history geek from around here, and I couldn't believe that I had not heard this story, number one. And then when I heard that basically the first and foremost lady of Tupperware, this trailblazer, had been basically eased out of the company and then written out of the company history, I thought it was a really interesting topic. And as I started to get into it, I found a lot more in terms of like sealed court cases in the Osceola County court system that had been sealed like 50 years. I researched both of their papers, Tupper and Wise, at the Smithsonian in 2005. And there's a lot of story there that wasn't covered in the documentary. And I think the book really fills in a lot of holes as to what happened between the two.
What did happen? Why was she let go from the company?
Well, Brownie obviously became a huge success in 52. And then in 54, she becomes the first woman on the cover of Business Week. And the Tupperware management made a very shrewd decision early on. You know, they were told, look, this is a great advertising strategy to have this woman as the out front head of the company. And that was great as long as sales were going well and Brownie had her eye on the ball. But around 56, 57, they started having some difficulty. There was a group of distributors who basically revolted and tried to overthrow Brownie. And that's an interesting part of the book that's not well known in the story. And then in 57, she wrote a self-help book, which, you know, with business figures today like Martha Stewart or Oprah, it's almost expected of them. But back then, it was still a pretty revolutionary thing. And Tupper wasn't real thrilled with the idea that all of a sudden, it was starting to be more, in his mind, about Brownie than it was about his baby, which was Tupperware, and that was always first and foremost with him. He wanted his baby to be the star, not Brownie.
Mm-hmm. Is that the self-help book you've got there?
Yeah, it's called Best Wishes, and it's basically a grouping of some of the speeches she gave and some of the things she would use to inspire women, and she really did inspire them. Her brilliance was communication, motivation. There were women who would lose 25 and 30 pounds to win the dress off her back in some of the competitions. That's how devoted they were to her. And she had this thing about making wishes come true at the annual jubilees. And it was always very dramatic. And it was thrilling for the women who had worked so hard to get to that position of having the recognition and rubbing elbows with Brownie. That's what everybody wanted to do. She had almost like a cult of personality around herself towards the end. And that's when Tupper decided enough's enough. I've kind of had enough of her. She had kind of gotten an inflated ego to where she thought it was all about her more so than Tupper. And, you know, like Shakespeare says, pride goeth before the fall.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering today if you were charting the success of somebody like Brownie Wise, do you think she would have, you know, come to the same position? I guess the business climate has changed a lot, and it's no longer unusual for a woman like Brownie Wise to, you know, rise to the level that she did back in the 1950s.
Oh, I think she'd be a huge success today. Mm-hmm. I mean, she just had the power of you know, motivation. She worked extremely hard. She traveled thousands of miles, and just looking at some of the memos she wrote to the dealers, she'd be up at 3 a.m. and, you know, making some motivational message to her dealers. So, I mean, she was completely devoted to, you know, the folks who were selling Tupperware and, you know, moving the product and making money almost to a fault, because I think so much of her life was wrapped up in this, you know, huge expansion of energy to make this happen, that in the end, when she was eased out, there wasn't a whole lot for her there to fall back on.
Mm-hmm. Talking about your research and writing this book, researching it at the Smithsonian, some not so ethical business practices in there. What did you find out about this?
In terms of Tupperware, in terms of the ethical or not so ethical business practices, there were some allegations towards the end. That, because Brownie sued after Tupper eased her out, and he was going to have her open up the books and see just exactly what money had been spent. And there was some question as to where some of the money had gone. Not necessarily that this was any sort of extortion or any sort of, where money was disappearing and it was going in her pocket, but more so just she had bought this private island. And she had the 1957 Jubilee on that island, and things went very terribly awry. And so it was like she was starting to mix her personal business with the professional business. And there were some questions about that, but nothing was ever brought to light because she did end up accepting a $35,000 settlement and mm-hmm. walking away.
And that was big money in those days.
To some degree, but consider the fact that 8 months later, Earl Tupper sold the company for $16 million. And this was the woman who basically put this product on the map. There are a lot of people that think she was really done wrong, and in that sense, she was.
Mm-hmm. What happened to her after that? I mean, was she able to find success elsewhere?
She limited. She started a company called Cinderella Cosmetics, which she tried to sell on the same home party system, but she couldn't recruit any of the people, or very few of the people, who'd been with her at Tupperware, because these folks had their livelihoods, you know, and their families wrapped up in Tupperware, and they just didn't have the same confidence about where Brownie was going. So that company went belly up.
Mm-hmm.
Then she had some real estate dealings where, you know, she made money. She was okay. And she also became an established artist, pottery. And she won a lot of awards and contests. And that's what she did for the rest of her life until she died in 1992 in Kissimmee.
Mm-hmm.
And she never really reconciled things with Tupperware either. You know, I've seen some different correspondence that suggests that the company was very active in burying her legacy long after she was out of power. We're talking 20, 30 years after. So Brownie never really got to come home before her death, and that's sad.
What about now? What does Tupperware think about Brownie Wise now, and especially, I guess, after your book and now with this movie in production?
They're very respectful of her, and you know the recent quotes I've seen, you know, now that the film is in the works, they value her legacy, and they realize, according to their public statements, what a trailblazer she was and what she did do and what she did accomplish. So, you know, what we're talking about in terms of her legacy being buried and that type of thing and being written out of the company history, that is history. And that's certainly not the position of the company today.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm talking to Bob Keeling. He's a reporter at Wesh TV. He's also the co-founder of the Jack Kerouac Writer-in-Residence Project. And we're talking about his book, Tupperware Unsealed, Brownie Wise, Earl Tupper and the Home Party Pioneers, set to become adopted into a movie by Sony Pictures. Well, let's talk about that a little bit, Bob. I mean, how did this book get into the hands of movie producers and become, you know, how do they greenlight the project, I guess?
Yeah, it's I call it a six-year overnight success. After the book came out in 2008, it was fortunate to get a long and positive write-up in the Wall Street Journal. And I think that got this whole notion back on Hollywood's radar. And then I had a producer ask me to see if he could sell it as a film. But this is way back in 2010. More recently, what happened is the story finally got on the radar of the writer, director, producer, Tate Taylor, who's best known for his film The Help in 2011, and also his excellent new James Brown biopic that was released in August. He got a hold of the story, and from what I've told, was just really enthralled by it. He's a Southerner. He's from Mississippi. You know, he seems to really specialize in Southern stories. And here you have Brownie, basically uneducated woman from Georgia. And then he was able to take it to an Academy Award winning actress by the name of Sandra Bullock and sell her on the idea. That's where it all really started to gain momentum within the last probably, you know, 6-8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And once she said she would do it, then all of a sudden you had companies like Sony, Warner Brothers, Paramount actually competing to get the rights to the book. So it was all very heady stuff, and it all sort of seemed unreal. I mean, I was stunned by it all and thrilled at the same time.
What about now? Is it sunk in?
Only to some degree, really. But I am excited about the possibilities, and I'm thrilled that as a sort of a spin-off result of all of this attention is that people around Central Florida especially are experiencing either an awakening to Brownie Wise or a reawakening. And as a result, I'm getting contacted by all sorts of people who used to know her, including an old-fashioned letter I got just yesterday from the family of a gentleman who was very instrumental in doing a lot of work around Tupperware's property way back in the day, and they're offering any help or insight. So it's been wonderful, really, the reaction.
What kind of role would you have in getting this movie off the ground? Do they come to you as a consultant, or are you allowed to sort of have some sort of input into the way the screenplay is written?
That's all still to be determined, and they may just tell me to, you know, stay out of the way and park the cars. I have no idea, but I would certainly welcome it. But I think with this film being in the very able hands of Tate Taylor and Sandra Bullock, I have faith that this is going to be a wonderful project to experience and a great film to see. I'm open to anything, but that's all still to be determined.
Mm-hmm. What about the timeline? Have they sort of said anything about when this might get going?
No, it's still so early. You know, the rights were only purchased in late July, so it's in what you call in development right now, and that involves, you know, having to do the work of casting other people, of course, writing the script, scouting locations. So there's all kinds of things to be done. It could be a matter of months. It could be a year. It could be 2 years. That's still sort of all up in the air because this is still so new.
We've had conversations on this program before with local filmmakers and people in the film industry here. Wouldn't it be fantastic if that came here? But I wonder if, how likely that is, given that it's such a big project.
Well, I would be thrilled with it. And I think the amount of jobs it could create, the economic impact it could have, the fact that there are still some sites here that, like the Angerbilt Hotel in downtown Orlando, which looks exactly the same as it did in 58 when the first chapter of the book unfolds. That's the backdrop. I'd love to see it, but I do wonder whether the you know, the incentives are in place at the state level to make it happen, or you know, some have suggested we could be a little bit more aggressive when it comes to that. And I would certainly hope that some of it might happen here, but again, it's just so early that those conversations are still to be had.
Mm-hmm. In terms of Tupperware itself, I mean, have you looked into what the company is up to now? And I'm wondering if they're ever able to sort of recapture the height of success they had while Brownie Wise was involved with the company.
Well, when you look at, I mean, this is a multi-billion dollar international company these days. I mean, mm-hmm. It is literally all over the world. It's a ubiquitous product. And I know they've branched out into other lines like cosmetics and different things like that. And I think that's a statement of success right there. And the fact that after this film was announced, for instance, we were getting inquiries from Indonesia, I mean, just from all over the world. There's a library search engine where you can go on and plug in the title of your book and see what libraries are carrying it. And literally, Tupperware Unsealed is carried as far away as Botswana and the Middle East and places like Harvard and Oxford. It's just a product that everybody knows about. But the book is not about the product per se. It's about the brilliant minds and the divergent personalities behind that product and how it became so ubiquitous. That's really the compelling story here.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the writer-in-residence project, the Jack Kerouac project. You know, we've had writers on this program that have been writers-in-residence. Just give us a quick overview of the organization, what it does, how it got started.
Way back, gosh, it's been 20 years ago, I was fairly new to Orlando, and I'd been down to Key West and saw the Ernest Hemingway house. And I really wished we had something like that here. And I would always bristle when people would say, oh, you're from Orlando. Oh, the theme parks. That's great. And, of course, as you all know, we're much more than that. And while they're a great economic engine for this city, you know, our largest employer is out there, you know, tip of the hat there. But there are so many great pre-Disney stories in Central Florida. And I'd heard that from my friend from the Midwest. He said Kerouac lived here or died here or something like that, and I thought it would be an interesting project to pursue. Mm-hmm. And his book of letters had come out right about the same time, so there were some addresses attached to some of his later letters from 1956. That's why I was able to find the first house in College Park, which is actually on Yates Street, which, oh, by the way, he made his final edits to On the Road in that house. And I just followed the story from there. His brother-in-law, who's the executor of the estate, was kind enough to let me know about the house on Clouser Avenue. That was 1996. I wrote an article about it for the Orlando Sentinel. Some folks in College Park decided this would be a great, you know, way to preserve the house and maybe start this writer-in-residence project. We were very fortunate to get some private donations early on, established the Kerouac Project and the Writers' Retreat in 1999. And since that point, we have had writers live there rent-free for 3 months at a time, from all over the world. Hong Kong, we've had a farmer from Perth, Australia. We've had a young man from Ocala. We've had Rollins graduates. So it really, and also in 2013, it was named to the National Register of Historic Places. And we're looking forward to having a Florida Heritage sign installed in the front yard here in the coming months.
Mm-hmm. How supportive do you think Central Florida and Orlando is to writers? Is this a good kind of petri dish, I guess, for generating talent?
I think no doubt about it. I think, you know, once writers get here and they find the length and breadth of the creative community here, you know, Billy Collins being the, you know, in residence over at Rollins College, I mean, that still blows my mind. But yet he is, you know, one of the most affable and friendly people you will meet. So I think Central Florida, Orlando is very supportive of writers, poets, creative people, and the Kerouac Project is one example of that.
Mm-hmm. And for yourself, I mean, you have a full-time job. You're still able to crank out a couple of these, you know, books every decade or so. So how do you do that?
Incrementally, a little bit at a time. And it is. It's about every 4 years is when I get a book out. But they all sort of have this pre-Disney Central Florida theme about them. And in fact, right now, I'm working on another book for University Press of Florida about young Elvis in Florida from 1955 to 61 and some of the amazing things that happened here in connection with his career. You'd be surprised. And just this week, I interviewed the woman who starred opposite Elvis in the film Follow That Dream that was filmed over in Crystal River. And it's just been a lot of fun. So hopefully that's going to be out in 2016.
Before you came to Florida, did you realize that there would be so many kind of links from other parts of the country, you know, paths intersecting here? That always strikes me as interesting, the way a lot of stories, you know, be they contemporary news stories or just historic, that they often have a track which cuts across Orlando.
You know, I've heard and I've said that eventually all roads lead to Orlando. And I actually believe that. There's just so much that goes on here. And I have to laugh at people who think that the state of Florida, you know, has no history or culture, because there are so many wonderful stories. And I've been here over 20 years, and I am still literally enchanted by all the things that have happened here. I love pursuing the stories. And I agree with you. I think there are some amazing stories that aren't that well known because they're all overshadowed by our reputation for tourism and being this vacation destination. And that's great. But there's much more below the surface when you just bother to take a look.
Mm-hmm. Would you, if you had your druthers, would you be a full-time writer, or do you enjoy having the freedom to be a TV journalist as well?
Oh, there is such an amazing aspect about the immediacy of day-to-day news and, you know, covering things like hurricanes and the space program. And that is a wonderful aspect of any journalist's career. So, no, I mean, it's been a great career to pursue, and I enjoy pursuing it. And it is definitely a great passion. Mm-hmm. So I think it's probably right just to sort of follow these stories a little bit at a time, to let them unfold, because a lot of times the passage of time helps you find these really critical sources that if you are more cranking them out, you might not necessarily take the time to find those people in those stories. And that's what gives these books more of a rich texture.
Mm-hmm. Just circling back to your work with researching Brownie Wise, are you thinking now, with the renewed interest in your book, that there's going to be a reprint, or are you looking to maybe add some stuff to it, or even with people kind of coming to you with new information, do you have another project in mind around this particular story?
Oh, I think there could absolutely be a postscript down the line. And yes, there are already some conversations about, you know, possibly doing a paperback version. There's all kinds of opportunities like that. And that's really the wonderful thing about this film interest, is I think it opens the door to a lot of other possibilities. And you know, certainly I stopped researching this, you know, in full throttle, if you will, in about 2007. And that always happens with books. You always get people after they come out saying, oh, did you know this and this and this? And you're mm-hmm. like, no, but I do now. So I think absolutely there could be some sort of possibility like that.
Well, Bob Keeling, congratulations on having this book greenlighted for a movie. It's fantastic, and look forward to reading your next work about the young Elvis, and we hope to have you back on the program. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for having me, Matthew. Appreciate it.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.